Our first speaker today is Dr. David Anderson. David is a professor and extension economist in the Department of Agricultural Economics at Texas A&M University. His research and extension activities are in livestock and food products marketing, ag policy. He focuses on issues that are relevant for Texas producers. He's a Texas AgriLife Extension Livestock Food Products Marketing Economist. His program is focused on research in the impact of alternative programs, farm programs, on the livestock, dairy, and crop sectors of agriculture. Dr. Anderson has done research and provided extension information on the wool, mohair, and dairy policy. Recent extension programs focused a lot on market outlook, animal identification systems, country of origin labeling. He also teaches an agricultural applied policy analysis course, primarily at the master's level. Dr. Anderson received a couple of degrees in agricultural economics from the University of Arizona, then earned his PhD at Texas A&M. Prior to returning to Texas A&M in 1996, he did work for the Colorado Agricultural Extension Service in the Livestock Marketing Information Center for a couple of years. He's received numerous awards for professional excellence, including awards from the American Agricultural Economics Association, the Outstanding Extension Program Award from both the Western and the Southern Agricultural Economics Associations, and the Texas A&M University Deputy Chancellor's Distinguished Performance Team Award for Research and Extension. Remember, as we go through the program, if you have questions for Dr. Anderson, please type them into the chat box and we will forward them to Dr. Anderson at the end of his presentation or at the end of the webinar. Dr. Anderson?
Well, thanks, Rodney. I don't believe I know that guy that had that big long introduction. But, you know, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here with everybody today. It's great to see so many participants and so many also friends and colleagues joining in for this, and I appreciate everybody that makes this session work, and thank you for all your work in this area. I'm going to cover a little bit about livestock policy update, livestock and grazing, and in keeping with the theme that of ag in uncertain times and drought. While I'm not going to address drought really directly, I do want to preface my comments in that, you know, I think 2013 is really a key year or a pivotal year for our livestock and dairy industries because of drought. With so much of the country in drought conditions, so much of our grazing lands stretching into our corn and soybean areas, whether we rely on grass and range and pasture or we rely on purchased feeds, I really can't help but think 2013 is really a critical year for the direction of our livestock and dairy industries. So, you know, with that, I'm going to hit kind of two broad areas, a little bit about the Farm Bill, and then other policy. You know, so much of livestock, as we deal with, whether we talk about commodity programs on the crop side, are so many of our livestock policies aren't those kinds of policies. There's other things. So I'll provide a few thoughts there, maybe, you know, kick off some thinking in a lot of those areas as well. If we look at the Farm Bill really as kind of this first area, you know, rather than talk about the old Farm Bill, which is new again with the extension, I think I'll try to keep my comments really sort of to the Farm Bills, and I have an S on that slide, really, because we got two bills out there. While we have an extension until whenever that changes, we've got some House and Senate versions out there that may or may not change, and we got a long ways to go to see where those fall out. But I think what's interesting, you know, if we look at the, whether it's the House or the Senate Farm Bill that are, you know, in limbo, pending, wherever they are, if we look at the last Farm Bill, there was a livestock title, I think, for the first time. This time around, in there is not a livestock title in either bill. If we look at the livestock title last time, it largely dealt with competition issues, market issues, directions to GPSA to do some work. Most of the explicit comments, though, were dealing with poultry industry issues. That whole title was pretty controversial in livestock circles, and some livestock segments of our livestock and dairy industry worked pretty actively to get rid of it. And so neither bill has a livestock title. If you look at Title 12 in the miscellaneous title, there are several authorizations, one dealing with feral hogs, which is a big deal for Texas in the South. But several items in that miscellaneous section. I should mention, too, dairy is a separate beast, and I say that I'm actually in Atlanta today for the Southern Dairy Conference, and it's dairy's a different beast, so that's all I'm going to say about dairy, I think, is just that. And certainly it has its separate title with a lot of controversial issues for the industry going on in the Dairy Security Act, so I'll leave that there. I think too, one of the comments I think that has been talked about a lot is in terms of risk shifting as we look at the policy climate for livestock. I think we might argue that the current direction has resulted in risk shifting. As we think about the crop insurance in response to for crop farmers with crop insurance as we hit the drought, certainly in 2011, the driest year on record in Texas, and then the drought last year in 2012, there's some risk management or risk protection there through crop insurance that we really don't have significantly on the livestock side. When I hear this term risk shifting, I guess I would say I'm not sure it's any different than ever before, given that we've had commodity programs, but we are. If we look at what's in the two farm bills, there is more of a feel of a crop insurance type of safety net program there, and certainly that is, if we think about this risk shifting notion, I'm not sure it's a lot different than any ever before, but this crop insurance feel or type of programs for farm commodity programs, I think at least leaves us thinking in that direction. And how do livestock producers, how are we going to continue to deal with these types of risks? Again, on that risk shifting theme, we do have some insurance products. Gross margin, using dairy as an example. In fact, in about an hour and a half, I'm doing a presentation at this dairy conference on LGM. We've got livestock risk protection, or LRP, available in for several livestock species. The pasture, rainfall, and forage insurance product, I think, has been used with some real success to help producers, certainly in Texas over the last couple of years with our drought issues. So there are some products there. Certainly in livestock, we have a different set of issues as we look at some of our species with integrated production. The issues are different. The risks are different. So in that regard, it does affect how we, how we look at those, how we really, what risks are we shifting, what are we mitigating, and how do we manage some of those, I think, are key issues there. So, just putting that in mind, I should say one other thing is that one of the issues in this is that in livestock, we've had, for these livestock insurance products, we've had about $20 million allocated for the premium subsidy or the underwriting portion from RMA, and that gets used up pretty fast. It's given the volatility. If we look at dairy, for instance, it's pretty easy to see how we've used up that money before the end of the fiscal year in the past and been unable to offer some insurance products. So certainly that funding level is a critical issue as to how we're going to deal with these, with livestock policies that provide some risk protection going forward. Let me say a few things about a bunch of other things. Animal ID, the final rule from APHIS USDA was published on January 9th, 2013. This has been a very controversial topic in livestock circles, particularly cattle, I think less so in dairy. But particularly in the cattle side, this has been a very contentious issue for a number of years, and USDA has gone back and forth and back to the drawing board, and now we've come out with this final rule. And if you start digging down into it, it really sets minimum national animal ID documentation requirements for livestock moving interstate. So if you're going between states, there's a set of documents there. But as setting a minimum, it leaves a lot up to the states as to how they're going to do that. For western states, if you look at this rule, brands are recognized with a brand inspection certificate if the receiving and shipping states agree that that's sufficient. I think that's a big change from past proposed rules on animal ID. Feeder cattle are exempt. They're going to be handled under a separate rule, and that's really cattle under 18 months old is that rule, and they are exempt from this rule. So really we're getting at breeding stock for this animal identification rule. And like I said, it leaves a lot up to the states. I'll give you an example from Texas. As of January 1, our animal identification system was put in place. All intact adult beef cattle and buffaloes or bison 18 months and older are subject to this, and Mexican origin event stock. So if you got some roping steers hanging around, roping steers are subject to this rule to move them around. So as identifications require a change of ownership, there's a number of types of tags that are acceptable for identification in the state. Interestingly enough, in Texas, in the Texas rule, a ranch brand registered with the county is not acceptable as official ID, though it is accepted for ownership. And the key there is in Texas, we have county registration of brands, and so you could have the same brand in different counties, and so therefore you don't really have ID that goes along with that, and that's different from other Western brand states. So, you know, I think this is one we're going to continue to see a lot of contentiousness certainly in the beef cattle areas as we go forward. But I think that Texas example compared to the national, what's in the national proposed rule, is kind of an interesting example. RFS, as a livestock economist, I would do a disservice if I didn't mention the RFS, particularly with more than 100 dairy producers downstairs who are still cranked up about this. But I think, as we all know, a temporary waiver was not granted. You know, I think most analysis showed or indicated that a temporary waiver would have done little to reduce corn prices in the short term. But, you know, I think we have to remember that what has been a significant push to higher corn prices over the last several years to the benefit of many corn soybean producers has really been disastrous for our livestock industries, and we're continuing to go through that adjustment. And I would say that I don't think this issue's gone away. Where we go with ethanol, where we go with the RFS, and that whole host of issues is not going away. A host of other stuff, whether we talk about antibiotic use, public land use, public land grazing, and regulations on that, animal welfare, what I would call a production process, rules, regulations, whether government or market participant enforced production process rules, I think we'll continue to see more of that in 2013 and more searching how this is going to shake out, whether from interest groups, consumer groups, broader interest groups and the like. Market issues, I put that there simply because we do have more consolidation going on as we look at the beef packing industry. We've got some more consolidation happening there. We've got market issues across that spectrum. And things like market and price reporting, market news, you know, how we report and do we report market prices in their current form. And more is just my catch-all for all the host of things that are going on in livestock industries. And I think that's my last slide. So hopefully that's provided a little food for thought, a little direction here, and I'll turn it back over to you, Rodney, as our host.
Well, thank you very much, David. We do have a few questions for you.
I was afraid of that.
two of them are related to dairy, and I will ask them first, and then the third is maybe a little more general in terms of livestock. But the first question related to dairy is, I guess in your opinion or your analysis, how effective is the livestock gross margin for dairy program? How effective has it been for dairy producers? And do you see that being expanded as a part of any new Farm Bill resolution?
To the end of that question, do I see that being expanded? I believe it was proposed, I don't know how far it's gotten, but to expand that pool of money as part of livestock insurance policies from to that $20 million to $50 million. I don't know how far that's gotten offhand, but I know that was being proposed. But certainly, you know, if that whole host or area of products is going to be effective or successful, we're going to have the money there to be able to support those and make those work as we do on the crop side. And so that limit, which really started out as a pilot kind of limit on the dollars, I think if we're going to see these being more effective, they're going to really have to expand. If we look at dairy particularly, it's interesting. One of the comments this morning at the conference was that one of the dairy producers said he felt like that as they observed, he thought there had been a lot of premiums paid but very little indemnity paid out. When we consider that this started in 2008, if I remember correctly, the LGM on dairy, 2009 was probably the most disastrous year financially on the dairy industry that anybody can remember. 2009 was a disaster with collapsing market prices. That was a great time for a product like that, but it was so new it wasn't widely used until later. We get to 2012, we also have had there's some argument whether 2012 has been worse than 2009, but largely because of skyrocketing feed costs crunching that margin as opposed to collapsing milk prices. So I think it's a mixed bag as to dairy LGM's effectiveness, but you know I think we're still in the process where people continue to try to learn whether it works for them, how it works best for them. But we do run up into that uncertainty at the end of every month on the sign-up day whether there's actually going to be funds available to even offer LGM, and I think that's a real detriment to its wider adoption.
David, we actually had another question come in from the audience that I'd like for you to address, and then after that we'll probably move on to our next speaker. But the question from the audience is, what do the new rules mean for in-state sales of older cows, like coal cows? What documentation now will be required to take coal cows to, say, for example, a local auction?
Well, if we look at that Texas rule, the Texas rule is, you know, anything older than 18 months old, you know, in a cow or a bull, when they change hands, and the person that has to comply is really on the seller to comply, but when they change hands. So, you know, if you raised your own heifers, they were cows, they went completely through their life and you kept them all the way through the production process, they don't change hands, you don't have to do anything. You haven't sold them, you haven't moved them. Now there is some exemption there for direct sales, you know, in terms, if I took it straight to the cow slaughter plant, in that regard, I believe as I look at those rules, they would be exempt. But, you know, for the national rule, it is for, you know, animals moving in interstate commerce. There's a number of ID tags, and there's a lot of changes in the types of tags that are allowable from one of these rules forward. But there's a set of things that are deemed acceptable, including breed registry. Papers and tattoos and tags and things like that are also deemed acceptable for ID.
Thank you, David. I think with that we'll move toward the next presenter. However, I would mention that if the audience will look in the question and answer chat box section of their screen, they will notice somebody did ask a question about making the presentations available on the website. And there's a website there where the actual presentations are currently available shortly after the webinar. The actual webinar recordings will be available on that same site. With that, I'd like to introduce our next speaker.